conscious, voluntary mother. And those men are inclined to accept the responsibility that best guarantees the happiness, security, thriving, and even survival of all those they father. The tremendous and constant upheaval in our current culture, the fractiousness around consent, the outrage of women directed at the men by whom they feel exploited, is a consequence of our foolish demands for two simultaneously impossible outcomes: full sexual freedom and complete predictability and security in the course of short-term sexual endeavors. These are impossible goals to jointly fulfill, because women who make themselves easily available for short-term sexual access will inevitably fall prey to the worst sort of men. There is no escape from this conundrum. The better men, who would behave in whatever manner might be deemed proper in such situations, are not going to be the men who are attracted to sequential, opportunistic, one-night stands. There is also every reason to assume that increasing the ease of sequential access to women trains men, who might otherwise be good, to adopt the habits of psychopathic and exploitative manipulators, particularly since we tend very strongly to become what we practice. Women who desire a libertine allowance, however hypothetically, also face another terrible conundrum. They may well find themselves attracted to precisely the sort of men who will take advantage at every turn, because the predatory parasites who adopt that strategy are adept at mimicking the charisma of the genuinely able and confident. Ironically, this tactic makes them particularly attractive to younger women who, because of inexperience, tend to be less able to distinguish between what is false and what is real in the masculine world. The importance of this realization and the magnitude of the danger that it poses can hardly be overstated. Sex itself literally evolved to protect life against parasites. A more compelling testimony to the depth of the peril can barely be imagined. Parasites generally reproduce faster than their hosts and can therefore evolve with more rapidity. Over time, this ability can pose a deadly threat to those whose resources are being consumed. Locked in an evolutionary arms race, the parasite continually attempts to modify its assault so that it becomes more efficient at overcoming the defensive mechanisms produced to forestall its advance. Because it can reproduce faster, however, it can generally win the battle in the medium to long run. Organisms that merely produce exact genetic clones of themselves therefore risk permanent eventual defeat on the biological battlefront. Sexual reproduction is a strategy that allows for a continual mixing of genes, however, and a consequently unpredictable and ever-transforming biological environment for the parasite to inhabit. The cost is sacrifice of the progression forward in time of the 50% of genetic material that is not replicated in any single act of sexual reproduction. Consider for a moment how massive the threat being avoided must be if almost all organisms, those that reproduce sexually, are willing to pay such a cost. To repeat, therefore, parasitism is such a severe problem that sex itself evolved in no small part to solve it. And sexual exploitation of women on the part of psychopathic, narcissistic, Machiavellian, and sadistic men is the human equivalent of parasitism. This is true with regard to reproduction itself, which is no small thing. But that is not all, as parasitical lifestyle is one of the clinically recognized diagnostic markers of the psychopathy firmly associated with multiple partners and reliance on short-term mating strategies. short-term means no investment in sexual partner or subsequent children, and no desire whatsoever for such investment, no matter how delightfully the strategy is presented, marketed, or spun. Make no mistake about it. The promised land of the sexual revolution is not occupied so much by the delightfully carefree, turn-on, tune-in, peaceful hippie dropout flower children of the juvenile 1960s progressive imagination, as by the outright monsters who care for nothing but the gratification of their own whims, no matter how that might be obtained. The long-promised sexual marketplace is, therefore, instead of the promised utopia, far too often a place of threat to women and children, often mortal in the latter case, as well as a great impediment to the security and happiness of both. In addition, it is something that works against the interest of truly good men. Why? For starters, the relatively commonplace nature of sexual assault, the widespread prevalence of abortion, by no means safe, legal, and rare, as so widely advertised prior to its liberalization, with close to 1 million conducted per year in the U.S. alone, and the increase of tension between single men and women. It is not by chance that university campuses are both hotbeds of sexual libertinism, often alcohol-fueled, and the very places that increasingly insist that every interaction between a young man and woman take explicitly contractual form. The establishment of such a secure covenant was, by the way, the eternal purpose of marriage. The employment, idiot enabling, and even celebration of what can so bloodlessly and easily be described as short-term mating strategies works across generations to destroy the trust that is vital between the sexes. Women once severely burned, as they are certain to be as the landscape becomes increasingly libertine, will tend strongly to adopt forever afterward a hypothetically protective skepticism, suspicion, and even hatred of men. The parasitic predators and the narrowly self-serving idiot hedonist strategies they both adopt and tout pose a mortal threat to the integrity of culture and community itself. The truly parasitic predators will burn everything to the ground to gain the opportunity to fornicate in the ashes. We are presently in great danger of enabling such players and their devious, camouflaged strategies. This is partly because of the naive or even willfully blind compassion that makes a victim, even of the purposeful and committed criminal, a manifestation or even pathologically extended variant of the aforementioned juvenile inexperience or outright immaturity that makes young women the prime targets of antisocial, manipulative, and exploitative men. It is also because our new Tower of Babel communication methods do not allow us to implement our age-old mechanisms of defense against the psychopathic narcissists, or worse, positively promote and enable the machinations of the psychopaths. As the heavyweight fighter Mike Tyson, a man perfectly capable of dispensing with the real monsters, famously put it, "Social media made you all way too comfortable with disrespecting people and not getting punched for it." What is the truly functional alternative? To adopt, promote, and celebrate the long-term monogamous mating strategies that are in the true best interest of children, women, men, and the social order alike. To oppose the celebration and the spread of the ethos of the hedonists, especially of the sexual variety. To aim up, tell the truth, and thereby find the redemptive romantic adventure of your life. In short, to walk and to indicate the straight and narrow pathway. Why? not least because if you conduct yourself in this manner, the story of your life will not only be adventure, but romantic adventure, as you are likely, as such a practitioner, to attract the best possible partner. This will also vastly increase the probability that you will have children, God willing, and that the high investment relationship you have with them, along with your wife or husband, will be the most profound good that has come your way. It is also fortunate in this regard that God appears to approve of sex, if only in the context of consecrated covenantal relationships. But of course, why would it be otherwise? How could it possibly be the case that the very continuation of the species could be properly pursued in a manner that was not in concordance with or was even opposed to the wishes of the Most High? Or, speaking biologically, in accord with the harmony of individual development, future stability, and the needs of the family and community. In keeping with this, is the theoretically unlikely, from the perspective of the utopian hedonists, fact that it is not the members of the wildly deviant fringe minority who are, on average, most successfully pursuing the pleasures to be found in the most private and intimate of physical moments. It is instead religious married couples who appear to have the most active sex lives. A more ironically comical psychological or sociological empirical observation is hardly imaginable this far into the 1960s inspired sexual revolution. It also turns out that the pursuit of sexual gratification in the absence of commitment and relationship is an endeavor that quite rapidly defeats even its own purposes while simultaneously putting everything stable about psyche and society at risk. The widespread acceptance of sexual licentiousness in our culture, more accurately, its avid promotion, often commercial, has turned young men into online sex addicts, pathetically mating with Tinkerbell, the porn fairy, often unable to perform with real women. The provision of a veritable plenitude of pornography in its increasingly diverse, inclusive, and equitable forms appears to be one of the major factors responsible for the radical decrease in actual sexual contact among young men and women. Its production and distribution, in concert with the rise of the ethos making such things possible, has destabilized the traditional family, increasingly leaving responsibility for children on the shoulders of women who take the path of single or unmarried motherhood, or who fall into it by motivated accident. One consequence of that? The radically increased distrust between men and women described as inevitable earlier. Another? The demoralization, devastation, and all too frequently, criminalization of a generation of fatherless children. Finally, although this is not an exhaustive analysis of consequences, it has enabled the rise of pride and in sexual identity as the prime publicly displayed virtue instead of the absolutely deadly and eternal sin that it is most truly. And why would anyone with any sense not want their sexual relationship consecrated? Why would you not most devoutly desire to elevate the act of physical intimacy with a loving, willing, and playful partner to the highest of all possible standards? Why would you remain unwilling to proclaim your intention to do so in front of your family, community, and state, so that your seriousness of intent is indicated and noted, society therefore informed and on board, and everyone on the same page? And why, if you truly loved the man or woman you chose for your partner and were simultaneously looking toward the long-term future including your own old age, would you choose anything other than the path of the parent and eventually grandfather or grandmother? What the hell else are you going to do, for example, in the two decades between the ages of 70 and 90? The idiot hedonism that so emphatically characterizes our age is something that can only work, even in principle, for those fortunate enough to be desirable. Young, healthy, able, willing, physically attractive, wealthy enough even to afford the spare time that such pursuits absolutely and finally demand. The alternative of participation in the mature order of relationship and sex does not necessitate a prim and proper Victorian, terrified of pregnancy and syphilis or sex itself, frigidity masquerading as moral virtue, as so often parodied by the hedonists, and sometimes true. But the proper placement of the sexual element of life into a thoroughly developed and sophisticated hierarchy of attentional priority. This means attending to your partner in imagination and deed. This means growing up and the consequent making of a generous and honest sacrificial reciprocity the true basis of your most fundamental relationship. If sex is devoted to God, then all shame and fear thereof vanishes, and the spirit of true play can emerge with full and enthusiastic enjoyment. This can be truly an approximation of paradise, as the attraction of romantic adventure, as the prime dramatic and literary genre, clearly indicates. This is also the pathway that best ensures the continuation of the generations, the pathway that best unites the demands of individual desire with the wants and needs that characterize not only individual life in its totality, but also the balance between those who live now and those who are yet to come in the future. God promises that Abram's descendants will spread everywhere and defeat all challengers. Why? Because those who walk the golden road win everything in the course of the endless game, as God promises, as previously indicated, after his prophet's most thorough sacrifice. Genesis 15, 17 to 21. We still find Sarai struggling at this point with her inability to conceive. After many years of disappointment, she encourages Abram to take her maid, Hagar, as another wife. This is an accurate representation of a conundrum faced by many couples, and one that often afflicts women most profoundly. In the majority of cases, particularly in later life, it is the woman who experiences infertility. As the brunt of the immediate and even later reproductive burden and all the remarkable transformations attendant during pregnancy, lactation, and dependent infant care falls on females, there is something particularly tragic about such an outcome. It is important to understand in this regard as well that women are accorded substantive status in accord with their apparent reproductive capacity, their apparent fertility, as indexed by the markers typically associated with female beauty. Preference for women with features indicating such capacity also appears cross-culturally and temporally stable, the beauty myth notwithstanding. Sarai's barrenness should thus be understood as a terrible cross for her to bear, as such a fate still can be and often is in the modern world. The male equivalent might be the pain experienced by those men who appear doomed by fate to an inescapable destiny of low comparative status, as that is the prime marker for attractiveness on the mating front for men. Hagar, once pregnant, decides to lord it over Sarai, her erstwhile mistress, on the basis of her pridefully paraded hypothetical female superiority. And Sarai said unto Abram, my wrong be upon thee. I have given my maid unto thy bosom. And when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between me and thee. Genesis 16:6. It is a man or woman blind indeed who does not see this play out in the modern world in patterns of female power-based jockeying for dominance, reputation savaging, and outright bullying. It must have been a series of pills, bitter indeed, for Sarai to swallow. First, to contend with the disappointment of failure to conceive. Second, to have this happen despite her apparent compliance with all of God's wishes. Third, to hand her husband over to a woman subservient in status to her. And finally, to suffer the insults of that very woman when the latter provides the desired outcome. The fact that Sarai is sentenced to barrenness despite her proper sacrifices must have been particularly galling, rivaled only in intensity by her subjugation to actual insult. This also reflects a particularly female existential tragedy. Involuntary childlessness, despite desire, opportunity, and appropriate moral effort, is a rejected sacrifice, very likely to cause a profound crisis in faith and hopelessness, even a Cain-like bitterness on the part of women, and understandably, although not helpfully so. 6.5. Sacrifice and transformation of identity. Abram, Sarai, and Jacob. It is at this point in the story that Abram becomes the much more well-known Abraham. The covenant he has established with God is renewed and extended once again. This time, it is implied, in a form so revolutionary that a change of identity occurs. And when Abram was 90 years old and 9, the Lord appeared to Abram and said unto him, I am the Almighty God. Walk before me and be thou perfect. And I will make my covenant between me and thee and will multiply thee exceedingly. And Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with thee, and thou shalt be a father of many nations. Neither shall thy name any more be called Abram, but thy name shall be Abraham, for a father of many nations have I made thee. And I will make thee exceeding fruitful, and I will make nations of thee, and kings shall come out of thee. Genesis 17:1-6. With time and effort, we change in small ways and in great. Small changes do not make us different people, but changes of sufficient magnitude can burst upon us like a rebirth. Indeed, the symbolic motif of rebirth, baptism, ritualistically, portrays or is designed to catalyze exactly that, as is the common practice of adolescent initiation. If our moral effort has been sufficiently diligent, we may find ourselves shaken to the very core, rearranged in entirety, attending now to different priorities, sequencing our actions in strikingly new ways. This happens when the most fundamental presumptions of value that guide our perceptions shift and change. This is apparently what happens to Abram, who is now walking before God and striving to be perfect, Genesis 17:1. The fact that he falls on his face, Genesis 17:3, while receiving the revelation from on high, emphasizes this point, that utter prostration in the face of what is eternally right means comprehensive voluntary subordination of what is narrowly self-serving and instrumental, impulsive, hedonistic, and deceptive, to what is properly highest, to what unifies, gives direction, quells anxiety, and provides the eternal wellspring of hope. This change is so complete, analogous to the case of Jacob, later Israel, that it requires signification with a new name. This is all part of now Abraham's continual renewal through adventure. His sojourn is not so much Sisyphean as progressive, not the same damned boulder up the same brutal mountain, but a continual traversing up and down toward higher and higher peaks, still an ordeal perhaps, but with direction. This is the very archetype of the successfully upward-aiming individual, the man who reestablishes the proper pattern of personal being after the catastrophe of chaos that is the flood and of order that is the doomed Tower of Babel. Nietzsche's arguably most famous aphorism is relevant in this context. He who has a why to live for can bear any how. Abram's original name means High Father. His new and transformed identity, Father of a Multitude, the perfection he is called to pursue as his sacrifices mount and his identity thereby transforms, is, in the most extreme case, what Christ much later calls on his followers to emulate, echoing the idea implicit in the barring of the gates of paradise, the flaming sword that turns every which way, refuses entry to the eternal garden or destroys anything that is not perfect before entry is allowed. Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father, which is in heaven, is perfect. Matthew 5:48. Insofar as Abraham is aiming up at the good or very good or even the perfect, he brings heaven to earth and shapes himself into a new Adam. This is the idea driven home in the following sequence of strange events. Abraham's descendants must now mark their covenant or contract with God with what? The sacrifice of all that which is extraneous? Perhaps. This is my covenant, which ye shall keep, between me and you and thy seed after thee. Every man-child among you shall be circumcised, and ye shall circumcise the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be a token of the covenant betwixt me and you. And he that is 8 days old shall be circumcised among you, every man-child in your generations, he that is born in the house or bought with money of any stranger, which is not of thy seed. He that is born in thy house, and he that is bought with thy money must needs be circumcised. And my covenant shall be in your flesh for an everlasting covenant. And the uncircumcised man-child, whose flesh of his foreskin is not circumcised, that soul shall be cut off from his people. He hath broken my covenant. Genesis 17:10-14. The designated and apparently requisite operation takes place on the most vulnerable part of the body, leaving it, if anything, even more vulnerable. This is then perhaps not only a gesture of casting away that which is superfluous, even a body part, and if thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee, for it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. And if thy right hand offend thee, cut it off and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. Matthew 5:29-30. But also perhaps an allusion to a fully exposed nakedness and acceptance of mortal fragility, a desire to walk once again unself-consciously and bravely without cover, without clothing, without deception, with God in the garden. These are dreamlike mysteries, still procedural, still embodied, rather than abstracted and explicitly understood. Their meaning transcends even the domain of imagination, remaining something that must be acted out and perhaps within a community to be understood. There is also an element of the blood sacrifice of Abel here rather than the bloodless offering of Cain. The extension of this requirement to everyone who is kin or partnered or subordinate to the true devotees of God indicates the hierarchical organization of the entire social structure under a single monotheistic animating spirit. The fact that the practice is instituted at all indicates the necessity for harmonious relationships with true alignment of aim, interest, and most fundamental identity as the precondition for the productive, generous, stable, and inspirational psyche and polity. Without that transcendent unity, there is directionlessness, no set path forward, chaos, too much possibility and choice, hopelessness, no beckoning ideal, disunity and consequent strife, as all pull in different directions. The danger of such disunity should not be underestimated. Diversity may under some conditions be strength, but can also more primordially result in confusion, disorientation, and the war of all against all. Does all that mean that circumcision is an existential necessity? It certainly means that some important sacrifice is necessary, and one that is collective in some vital sense, in order for any community to establish itself, coalesce, and thrive. Sarai, my princess, gains a new identity as well, becoming Sarah, princess as such. Her progeny are also promised to be numerous beyond count. That transformation of essential personhood is marked by God's promise to bless her, despite her advanced years, with a son as reward for her moral effort and upward striving, equal in its intensity and faithfulness to that of her husband. She is thus no longer mere partner of Abram, high father, honor though that was, but the very mother of kings and nations. Her status is no longer head of one family, but of multitudes. She is now therefore mother as such, just as Abraham is now father in the same manner. An analogous transformation of identity occurs in the case of Abram's, now Abraham's, grandson Jacob. The mother of Jacob, Rebekah, was barren, like Sarai, now Sarah. She prayed for children and conceived twins, Jacob and Esau. Their relationship has a Cain and Abel quality to it, the struggle between hostile brothers, right from the beginning. They fight in the womb, and Jacob comes out literally clutching at Esau's heel, Genesis 25:26, an event that is simultaneously the source of his name, as Yaakov in Hebrew is connected to the verb akev, which means, as well as heel, to take hold of, outwit, or supplant. Thus, the one who lays hold of the heel can be well construed as a deceiver or usurper, as in Lucifer tempting Eve, Adam, and Cain. This designation beautifully suits Jacob, who conspires with his mother to deprive Esau of the firstborn rights that are his due. Esau is a wild man, stereotypically masculine, hirsute, continually outdoors, a hunter and the favorite of his father, Isaac, Abraham's son. Jacob, by contrast, is a tent dweller, more bookish, more devious in the intellectual manner, more civilized with all the accompanying virtues and vices, and the favorite of his mother, a veritable mama's boy. The first act of duplicity has Jacob taking advantage of Esau's impulsive nature and wild heedlessness of the future. And Jacob sawed pottage, and Esau came from the field, and he was faint. And Esau said to Jacob, "Feed me, I pray thee, with that same red pottage, for I am faint." Therefore was his name called Edom. And Jacob said, "Sell me this day thy birthright." And Esau said, "Behold, I am at the point to die. And what profit shall this birthright do to me?" And Jacob said, "Swear to me this day." And he sware unto him, and he sold his birthright unto Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils. And he did eat and drink, and rose up and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Genesis 25, 29 to 34. This episode begins with Jacob preparing food. Esau is ravenous and requests something to eat. Jacob provides the food, but at great cost. He convinces his elder brother to give up his rights as firstborn. In ancient Hebrew culture, the birthright was a special honor given to the firstborn son. The birthright holder, designated the principal heir, was entitled to receive twice as much of the inheritance as any other heirs. The firstborn also had the responsibility of carrying on the family name and could exercise considerable authority over younger siblings. It is all this that Esau trades so carelessly for his bowl of porridge. The elder brother, however, cannot be saddled with all the blame. This offer to trade is a very conniving act on the part of Jacob, and a setup, the text implies, that has been long thought through. It is as if the vices of the two brothers meet on this occasion and establish this appalling mutual covenant. Something of this sort, although worse, happens again later. Isaac, old, blind, and near death, desires a potentially final meal to be prepared by his favorite son, the hunter Esau. "Now, therefore take, I pray thee, thy weapons, thy quiver and thy bow, and go out to the field and take me some venison, and make me savory meat such as I love, and bring it to me, that I may eat, that my soul may bless thee before I die." Genesis 27, 3-4. Isaac makes this request in preparation to once again lay upon Esau the blessing that is rightfully his, in spite of Jacob's earlier attempts to usurp those rights for himself. However, Rebekah orchestrates a plan for Jacob to pose as Esau so that the great gift might be unjustly his. Jacob, dressed in Esau's clothes and goatskins to mimic Esau's hairiness, brings Isaac a meal and successfully convinces his father that he is Esau. And he came near and kissed him, and he smelled the smell of his raiment and blessed him and said, "See, the smell of my son is as the smell of a field which the Lord hath blessed. Therefore God give thee of the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth and plenty of corn and wine. Let people serve thee and nations bow down to thee. Be Lord over thy brethren, and let thy mother's sons bow down to thee. Cursed be everyone that curseth thee, and blessed be he that blesseth thee." Genesis 27, 27-29. When Esau returns and realizes Jacob has taken his blessing, he cries out to Isaac, "Hast thou not reserved a blessing for me?" Genesis 27, 36. We can well imagine the father of the antagonistic sons both distressed and infuriated by the second deception. He is morally obligated by the standards of his time, however, to stand by the words he has uttered. Thus, the great blessing for Jacob is maintained and the lesser granted to Esau. Jacob nonetheless pays a great price for his deception. Esau, furious at this turn of events, plots to kill his conniving brother after Isaac's death. Jacob therefore finds it immediately necessary to flee from his family, thus, and fortunately, separating himself from his mother, and to apprentice himself to his uncle Laban. This is where his adventure as a man of truth instead of falsehood begins. This is when he starts to transform himself into the likeness of his grandfather, Abraham, and to become a man who incarnates the Logos. Arriving in Haran, the home of Laban, Jacob encounters Rachel, Laban's younger daughter, at a well and is struck by her beauty. Genesis 29:10-11. Haran, it should be noted, is a place of crossroads or choice. Haran is also the place where Abraham tarried for a time and where Lot turned away from his uncle towards Sodom. Genesis 11:31. The first events that transpire at or near Haran in relationship to Jacob are in precise keeping with this theme of choice. And Jacob went out from Beersheba and went towards Haran. And he lighted upon a certain place and tarried there all night because the sun was set. And he took of the stones of that place and put them for his pillows and lay down in that place to sleep. And he dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham thy father and the God of Isaac. The land whereon thou liest, to thee will I give it and to thy seed. And thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth, and thou shalt spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south, and in thee and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And behold, I am with thee, and will keep thee in all places whither thou goest, and will bring thee again into this land. For I will not leave thee until I have done that which I have spoken to thee of. Genesis 28:10-15. Jacob dreams of the upward spiraling aim that connects earth with the divine at Haran, at the place of fundamental decision. The idea of expanding opportunity and sacrificial progression is thereby revealed to him in the form of his heavenly vision, which presents an archetypal image of the succession of upward choice. Instead of living a life of deceit and treachery, conniving with his mother, he could aim up, striving toward the good that at its pinnacle is identical with God, the spirit of his prophetic ancestors. This is the decision that everyone who decides to change and improve makes, regardless of how minimal a step they first take when they decide to ascend, and no matter how unclear their vision of the ultimate up. This is partly because every decision to move truly forward increases the ability to see where up lies, and partly because every upward decision makes the next such decision more likely. Thus, the starting point is eternally less important than the intent. This is good news indeed for the man who, like Jacob, has many flaws. Good news for everyone, flawed as we all are, particularly when we begin our adventurous strivings upward. After his realization that it is indeed possible to aim heavenward, that is, after his dream, Jacob swears to make the attempt. He determines to sacrifice his previous mode of being and to establish a new covenant with God. This is marked by the following acts, which duplicate the pattern of Abram's altar building and offering. And Jacob rose up early in the morning and took the stone that he had put for his pillows and set it up for a pillar and poured oil upon the top of it. And he called the name of that place Bethel, but the name of that city was called Luz at the first. And Jacob vowed a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God. Genesis 28, 18 to 21. Hard choices do further confront Jacob after leaving home, although he has now determined to aim up. He contracts with his uncle to work for 7 years, for example, to earn Rachel's hand in marriage, and he makes this sacrifice happily. And Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed unto him but a few days for the love he had. Genesis 29, 20. This is the first endeavor of true service that Jacob embarks on in good faith, in service to a higher goal. It indicates some genuine maturation, some movement toward integrity, some upward-aiming transformation of character. After Jacob offers 7 years of reliable labor, he celebrates his wedding day with Rachel, as promised. Laban, however, conspires to slip Leah, his eldest daughter, into Jacob's tent on the night of the marriage in place of Rachel, and the matrimonial union is consecrated with the substitute daughter. Laban has his reasons. As a father, he has a responsibility to see his oldest daughter settled first. That does not fully, or perhaps even at all, excuse his actions. He could have stuck with his deal. Alternatively, he could have attempted to negotiate the situation honestly with Jacob, explaining his fatherly predicament and that of his eldest daughter, instead of relying on deception. Perhaps more surprising is that Jacob falls for the substitution. The text is not entirely clear why. Situational factors unique to the culture in question clearly played a role. Brides at that time would have been heavily veiled during both the daytime celebration and when they were brought to their groom's tent at night. The particulars notwithstanding, Laban manages his duplicitous act, which is realized only by Jacob at the dawn of the next day. And it came to pass in the morning, behold, it was Leah. Genesis 29, 25. Given the tricks he played on his brother Esau with his mother's help, Jacob might not be regarded by a perspicacious reader as deserving of any real sympathy. What befalls Laban's nephew seems more in the vein of poetic justice or karma, although Rachel seems truly and undeservedly to be given the wrong end of the stick. The moral of this part of the story might be regarded as twofold in biblical terms. First, that no sin goes unrecognized or unpunished. For there is nothing covered that shall not be revealed, and hid that shall not be known. Matthew 10, 26. Second, that those who live by the sword are likely to die by the sword. A colloquial variant of Matthew 26, 52. Perhaps if Jacob had not lived by the lie himself for so long, and thereby clouded his vision, he might have been wise enough either to discover Laban's manipulations, and perhaps very early, or even to have conducted himself in a manner that would have made his targeting by such treachery unlikely. Oh, what a tangled web we weave when we first practice to deceive, as the Scottish poet Sir Walter Scott laments. To what degree do people open themselves up to betrayal by broadcasting, however unconsciously, their suitability for exactly that fate? It is a rare man indeed who does not long, at least in the deepest recesses of his soul, for the punishment that resets the moral order in the aftermath of committing a crime. Why? Because a world that appears to lack any true up or down is a place both terrifying and hopeless. In any case, Jacob accepts Leah as his wife. In doing so, he repeats the faithful pattern of his father, Isaac, who stuck to his words after delivering Jacob the blessing that should have been Esau's. The deed is done, however crookedly, and Laban's now moral nephew accepts responsibility for the outcome. In consequence, perhaps, Laban offers Jacob a new deal. He can work for another 7 years, and at the end of that, truly obtain Rachel's hand. And Jacob did so and fulfilled her week, and he gave him Rachel, his daughter, to wife also. Genesis 29:28. We can imagine Jacob much wiser by the end of that second apprenticeship and sacrifice. He has labored for 14 years. In the process, he has accumulated large family and substantial wealth, proving himself in the interim a good father and productive steward. He has undergone a series of transformations reminiscent of those that characterized Abram. Further, it is perhaps reasonable for God and fate to have demanded of Jacob some 14 years of sacrifice so he could redeem himself after his misadventures with Esau. The parallels between Jacob and Abram continue. Rachel is barren, like Sarai, and requests that Jacob take her handmaiden, Bilhah, so that children might be forthcoming, just as Sarai did with her maid and husband. This endeavor is successful, and Rachel appears grateful for it. This is the first intimation in this story of the great difficulties of negotiating with fate. After a second son is born to Bilhah, Rachel proclaims, "With great wrestlings have I wrestled with my sister, and I have prevailed." Genesis 30:8. She has to take the long route to children through the means of another woman, but she considers herself blessed by the outcome and appears to accept the children as her own. This is not a situation without its complexities, obviously, particularly given the comparative fecundity of Leah. But it is a solution much better than some. And in managing to reconcile herself gratefully with fate, Rachel indicates the strength of character that is perhaps part of Jacob's attraction to her. Things turn around, too, for her, just as they did for her grandmother. And God remembered Rachel, and God hearkened to her and opened her womb. And she conceived and bore a son and said, "God hath taken away my reproach." And she called his name Joseph and said, "The Lord shall add to me another son." Genesis 30:22-24. Perhaps she did everything that was in her power to ensure that outcome. In any case, Rachel is truly blessed, a truly archetypal positive mother. It is appropriate then that her son Joseph becomes a type of Christ himself and does great things. At this point, Jacob begins to long for home. There are several reasons for this. First, he manages his uncle's flocks and affairs with great success, arranging to take a portion for himself, with which he does even better. This transforms him into something of a competitor in Laban's eyes, and tension grows between them. Second, it is intimated in the text that Jacob's conscience is calling on him to return to the place of his youthful treachery, rejoin his family, and above all, reconcile with his brother. The act of parting with Laban, who seems to be somewhat of a complicated character, has its troubles, but it is something finally managed in peace. Genesis 31. The hero of the story, accompanied by his wives, concubines, and substantial possessions, is now able to make his way toward the land of his birth. He sends messengers forward to Esau, announcing his approach and indicating his hope that his older brother can show him grace. When the messengers return, however, they indicate that Esau has set out to meet him in the company of no less than 400 men. This worries Jacob greatly, as he now anticipates an armed force. He reaffirms his relationship with God in prayer and sets forward, despite the news, determining as he does so to offer a gift to his estranged brother. This is obviously another penitential sacrifice, this time in the service of both apology and peace. He divides a very substantial number of his goats, camels, cows, and donkeys into multiple separate herds, sending them ahead with their tenders, telling him to let Esau know that each is a separate offering from his brother and that Jacob himself will be following at the end of the procession. Jacob then sends his wives across the river that borders his brother's territory, staying alone for one more night before making that crossing himself. It is there, on the very edge of his potential reconciliation with or his death at the hands of his brother, that he has another transformative experience. And Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. And when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, "Let me go, for the day breaketh." And he said, "I will not let thee go, except thou bless me." And he said unto him, "What is thy name?" And he said, "Jacob." And he said, "Thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and hast prevailed." And Jacob asked him and said, "Tell me, I pray thee, thy name." And he said, "Wherefore is it that thou dost ask after my name?" And he blessed them there. And Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, "For I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved." Genesis 32, 24 to 30. On the edge of his homeland, on the very border between who he is now and who he was, on the verge of facing all the remaining consequences of who he was, Jacob, of course, wrestles with God, as we all do when we face the most difficult of decisions. What path will we choose? What will we allow or call upon to guide us? What spirit will possess us in our decision? The wrestling partner contending with Jacob is first presented as a man, but later revealed as God, the very God we wrestle with when attempting to make our difficult way forward. And who are the truly chosen people according to this account? All those who wrestle with God honestly and forthrightly and prevail. Jacob sustains some genuine damage in the contest, as we are all likely to do when the most difficult decisions of our life present themselves. But he comes out of the battle firm in his conviction to do right. He fords the river, faces his estranged brother, atones for his past, and makes a productive and united peace, establishing, like the God he now worships, the order that is good. This agonizing decision transforms him so completely that, like Abram, he now has a new identity, a new name. He is now Israel, he who wrestles with God. The fact of that transformation is reiterated later in the account when God furthers his covenant with Jacob, promising him a destiny very much like that of his equally transformed grandfather. And God said unto him, "Thy name is Jacob. Thy name shall not be called any more Jacob, but Israel shall be thy name." And he called his name Israel. And God said unto him, "I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall be of thee, and kings shall come out of thy loins. And the land which I gave Abraham and Isaac, to thee I will give it, and to thy seed after thee will I give the land." Genesis 35, 10 to 12. Jacob, like Abram, began his adventure on the wrong foot. Both men determined to set themselves straight despite their substantial flaws and made a covenant with God to do exactly that. That is a decision, a moral decision, and it is the decision to begin the journey up, to mount the spiral of Jacob's ladder toward the highest good. They then face a horizon of expanding opportunities, each of which demand in sequence a sacrifice of increasing magnitude, a maturation and transformation of character. In the case of both protagonists, this transformation proceeds to a point so revolutionary that the men who undergo it are in some sense reborn and become new people, hence their new names, Abraham, father of nations, and Israel, he who wrestles with God. If that wrestling is done in the proper spirit, there is no difference whatsoever between those two newly bestowed, fully integrated, and properly sacrificial identities. 6.6. With the angels into the abyss. When we left Abram and Sarai, they had just been transformed into Abraham and Sarah, the former after foregoing great gain to do the right thing in the eventually successful role of a warrior. The latter, after enduring her barrenness forthrightly, maintaining her faith unshaken despite her somewhat bitter fate, even in the face of the presumption of her maid, Hagar, now the mother of her husband's first child. The couple is visited at this time by strangers, three of them, to whom they extend a courteous and inviting welcome. "Let a little water, I pray you, be fetched, and wash your feet, and rest yourselves under the tree, and I will fetch a morsel of bread and comfort ye your hearts. After that ye shall pass on, for therefore are ye come to your servant." And they said, "So do as thou hast said." And Abraham hastened into the tent unto Sarah and said, "Make ready quickly 3 measures of fine meal, knead it, and make cakes upon the hearth." And Abraham ran unto the herd and fetched a calf tender and good, and gave it unto a young man, and he hasted to dress it. And he took butter and milk, and the calf which he had dressed, and set it before them. And he stood by them under the tree, and they did eat. Genesis 18:4-8. Those who are striving to be perfect welcome each encounter as a divine opportunity and further call to adventure. This turns out to be extremely fortunate in the case before us, as the visiting trio are soon revealed to be emissaries of the divine itself, if not angels, or even God himself. What might this mean? At one level, that each encountered person is made in the image of God and is therefore a lurking angel, an avatar of the transcendent animating unity. This makes each meeting, even between strangers, an opportunity and a call, an opportunity for whatever might result from reciprocal exchange, and that can be plenty, a reminder to do right by each person and not to take advantage, particularly of people who, like these strangers, are vulnerable in consequence of their current dislocation and homelessness. It is very easy to underestimate, or worse, lord it over new acquaintances, particularly if they are, however temporarily, in straitened circumstances. God only knows what opportunities are lost for productive joint work and development of character in consequence of such pride. The proper response to that opportunity and call is instead precisely what is expressed by Abraham and his wife: gratitude for the encounter, humility in its receipt, and therefore openness to the possibilities of exchange, and hospitality, generous sharing with no holding back or resentment. Both members of the couple appear to consider the visit a veritable privilege, despite its unexpected nature. Imagine what it would mean for the state of the world if everyone treated every encounter in that way. It is instructive to contemplate the contrary as well. People who are faithless, narrowly selfish, begrudging, suspicious, and resentful in their offerings, and that certainly includes their hospitality or lack thereof, will find themselves rejected by others, by themselves, and by God. Pauline epistle, 2 Corinthians 9, 6 to 8, puts it this way. But this I say, he which soweth sparingly shall reap also sparingly, and he which soweth bountifully shall reap also bountifully. Every man according as he purposeth in his heart. So let him give not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loveth a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that ye, always having all sufficiency in all things, may abound to every good work. It is, of course, Jesus who sets the ultimate standard for his followers in keeping with such notions, the aforementioned call to perfection in the name of the Father, Matthew 5, 48. The strangers reassure Sarah that God's promise of fruitfulness will be fulfilled. Note here the strange conjunction of hospitality with fertility. It is the warm and proper welcome that Sarah offers, in keeping with or as a reflection of her faithful character, that inspires God to smile upon her, even to grant her more impossible wishes. It is important to establish this understanding now, so that the later events that unfold in Sodom itself, the epitome of the inhospitable city, can be understood in all the details of their complexity. Abraham's still barren wife has entered menopause, however, believes a child to be impossible in consequence, and laughs, no doubt somewhat ruefully, within herself, Genesis 18:12. Her husband, inspired by God, upbraids her for her momentary faithlessness, saying, "Is anything too hard for the Lord?" Genesis 18:13. It is easy for the modern mind to side with Sarah at a moment like this, but it is Abraham whose apparently unreasonable faith proves eventually justified. Perhaps God forgives her for her skepticism, as false hope in such regard is a particularly heavy cross to bear. In any case, the couple lay the matter aside, at least temporarily, turning their attention toward the now threatened Sodom while despairing of its faithlessness and sin. They lay out their intentions to investigate the city's situation further, but, suspecting the worst, note that the city is indeed in grave danger of destruction. And the Lord said, "Because the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grievous, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the cry of it, which has come unto me. And if not, I will know." Genesis 18:20-21. "Have done altogether" means carried their iniquity to perfection, to the highest pitch of wickedness. Presumably, had they not done so, there would still be room for mercy. Abraham intercedes, objecting to the potential injustice of destroying the worthy in these cities, along with the sinful. It is here that he bargains or wrestles with God quite directly, suggesting first that the city be spared if 50 righteous men can be found there, negotiating in a daring manner, pushing the limit of the details of the covenant, getting God to agree to spare the city if even 45, then 30, then 20, then 10 can be found, determining to travel to the dangerous metropolis to find those good men. Genesis 18:22-33. What does this mean? If a community steps off the path, journeying toward a totalitarian madness, a collective impulsive hedonism, a Luciferian pride, or a compact of lies and conspiratorial silence, it might still be salvageable if the moral catastrophe has not engulfed everyone who could yet think and speak. The truth, perhaps, is so powerful that even a few unstilled voices can redeem the rest, perhaps even one crying in the wilderness, John 1:23. It is therefore incumbent on each of us, reflecting the image of God respectfully, to be among the 10, or even to be the one. This is precisely what is demanded much later of the unwilling Jonah, as we shall eventually see. Two of the angels accompany Abraham to Sodom, joining Lot there. He extends the hospitality that typified his uncle and aunt to the visitors, although they first insist on staying in the street. He prevails upon them, nonetheless, to accept his invitation. They do so, entering his house and dining there on unleavened bread. Why the latter? Because in that corrupt and licentious town, it is necessary to take nourishment and fortification only from what is truly unadulterated. Then the story takes a terrible and perverse twist. But before they lay down, the men of the city, even the men of Sodom, compassed the house round, both old and young, all the people from every quarter. And they called unto Lot and said unto him, Where are the men which came into thee this night? Bring them out unto us, that we may know them. Genesis 19, 4-5. No, here is the biblical no. It is the proper word for intimate congress, as the exploration that makes that act possible and properly done is a very deep form of knowledge indeed. But in this context, it means violently gang rape and in the most inhospitable and unproductive manner possible. Precisely that manner which has come to be identified with the city's name. The Sodomites welcome their guests in the worst possible way, violating their integrity, and doing so such that nothing creative or productive could possibly emerge in consequence of their actions. This barrenness of intercourse is contrasted at least implicitly with the warm and proper embrace of Sarah in consort with Abraham that eventually guarantees her fertility. The actions of the men of Sodom are both hostile and sterile, and that conjunction is emblematic of the dangerous fallenness of the city. In the face of this threat, Lot then does something that runs absolutely contrary to the mores of the modern world. His response is detailed in one of those biblical passages those with just enough knowledge to be dangerous frequently point to when trying mightily to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Abraham's nephew offers his two virginal daughters to the mob, insisting that his duty to hospitality, which they theoretically share as a sacred obligation, means that he must above all protect his guests. This does nothing, however, but further tempt and enrage the mob. And Lot went out at the door unto them and shut the door after him and said, I pray you, brethren, do not so wickedly. Behold now, I have two daughters which have not known man. Let me, I pray you, bring them out unto you and do ye to them as is good in your eyes. Only unto these men do nothing, for therefore came they under the shadow of my roof. And they said, Stand back. And they said again, This one fellow came into sojourn, and he will needs be a judge. Now we will deal worse with thee than with them. And they pressed sore upon the man, even Lot, and came near to break the door. Genesis 19, 6-9. When the Sodomites gathered so threateningly at the door are reminded that they, like Lot, bear an intrinsic moral responsibility, not least to maintain hospitality, not least to serve whatever gods hypothetically guide them, they forego the self-examination that should occur, rejecting the realization and confession of their wrongdoing, and double down in the manner typical of power-mad and hedonistic tyrants. They even express a resentful outrage, not over their own actions, but over Lot's pretensions in daring to serve as judge, particularly given his position as a foreigner, indicating their true status as children of Cain in so doing. In consequence, instead of listening and in the further celebration of their now self-righteous rage, They threaten Lot with worse even than they wish to press on his guests. Everything about the description of that response is correct psychologically. It is forever the case that those called to account in the midst of their iniquity will turn their full fury on the messenger rather than attending to their own willful blindness. Idiot hedonism, that is a phrase too weak to indicate the true magnitude of such error, and malevolence. It is also the case that such fury is likely to be amplified if it is someone foreign who presumes to point out sin. It is necessary to understand exactly why hospitality was considered sacred at the time of the account of Sodom and Gomorrah to fully comprehend the meaning of this section.